morning, folks. It's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the real challenges facing Arizonans. Good morning, folks. Steve Williamson here, sitting across from me, my beloved co-host.
Mike Cosentino here, celebrating, or, I don't know, mourning the fact that we no longer live in a democracy, according to Princeton University. This is, a democracy is over. We're going to talk a little bit about that today, right, there, Steve?
We are, and we have silent Gary LeMaster, who hopefully will not be silent, since he's handed us a five-page handout research on the issues we're going to be talking about today.
Brilliant analysis. Now, on how we got here. How did we get to not be a democracy in 2015?
Right. So last week we talked about oligarchy.
Yeah.
This week we're sort of talking about it again. And the reason is the oligarchy, the concentration of wealth in a few hands, is getting worse and worse and worse. And it has implications for having a democracy, right, Mike?
Right, where government can't save you anymore. So it's run by rich people.
So when we've talked about a lot of different aspects of this, like dark money. We'll talk about dark money again. Dark money, all these secret contributions, Citizens United, are all pieces of this puzzle.
Right.
Pieces of this puzzle.
Really, what's the perfect storm to create this? An incredible oligarchy that we have in the U.S.
So what's happening now is what they call the New Gilded Age. And after the Civil War, the United States industrialized. And there's a period between about 1870 and the early 1900s, what they call the Gilded Age. The term is by American writer Mark Twain, you know, Tom Sawyer fame and stuff.
Huck fan, we like to think.
And Tom and the guys watching us, Mark Twain said, what is the chief end of man? To get rich. He said, in what way? Dishonestly, if you can, and honestly, if we must.
If you have to, yeah.
So a lot of the money being made is, I guess you wouldn't say it was dishonestly, it's just non-productive. Romney is making his wealth, and I just pick him because when he ran for office, folks got at least a picture of what was actually going on. Romney's not making anything. And most of the wealthy people in the United States, the top 1% of the 1%, or the top 10% of the 1%, or the top, you know, whatever, are making their money by manipulating money.
Yeah.
Yeah, and manipulating stock. They break up companies, they split it up, they lay off workers. It's not like Apple. Now, so during a Gilded Age, you could see visible things happening. One, you're sitting in Pittsburgh and suddenly there's a steel factory there. You're in St. Louis and suddenly a train comes all the way and then it's headed west. So you have a period when the United States went from one of the less industrial countries in the world to the most in terms of its production. And you have this vast difference in wealth. This, toward the end of it, you have these preposterous displays of health and wealth. If you go to the East Coast, you can see these folks' houses. They call their mansions in Newport, Rhode Island, cottages. Go up to the cottage and things like this. The famous thing, there was a party, and they give these lavish parties, and the famous thing, and the woman's name is Stuyvesant Fish. Well, why is her first name Stuyvesant? You know, it's because Peter Stuyvesant, you know, basically founded New York. Right. So anyway, she has a party, and she brings her dog in with the diamond collar, which in, I think, you know, like 1906 or something, is worth $15,000. That's the height of the thing. It's probably now worth, you know, $500,000. So you get a combination of wealth, the conspicuous display of wealth, and you get, and I was talking to Mike before the show, Mike, right, about, are people even taught the history of it? I mean, there's all these radical political parties that get generated. There's all these cults and everything generated by the dislocation of agricultural people by this vast industrial wealth.
The education system still has a course in U.S. history, and yes, those things are taught. Whether anybody's listening, that's another story.
So That's the old Gilded Age. And the reason people talk about this being the new Gilded Age, the Gilded Age was where the differential between the top, the wealthiest people in the country, and everybody else was greatest. And now, right, Gary, we're going into a period where it's returned.
Robert Reich's movie, Inequality for All, a great, great little flick. Check it out. Explains it rather well. I want to mention W.A. Clark, since we have Clarkdale down the street. He was one of those Gilded Age oligarchs. And the only reason you don't hear about W.A., there's a wonderful book called Empty Mansions, by the way, written about W.A. Clark, because his youngest daughter just died here 4 or 5 years ago. The Rockefellers and the Fords and the J.P. Morgans and the Carnegies all paid their people crap and made a lot of money. W.A. Clark actually paid more. So there weren't the strikes. You know, I'm sure Gary's going to talk about, we are going to talk about the war. During the Gilded Age, America's war with itself. I mean, you know,
Second Civil War.
Senator Marco Rubio is running for office, and Senator Rubio, who wants to be president of the United States, says America has never been a nation of haves and have-nots. We are a nation of haves and soon-to-haves, of people who have made it and people who will make it. What do you guys, what's your take on that?
There's not a stupider man walking and breathing.
I don't know. I'd say the rest of the GOP clown caravan pretty much exceeds
like
him.
But
guess which country has the least social mobility of the industrialized world?
The U.S.
The U.S. It has less social mobility than the industrialized world. So when they have a portrait, it's the American dream, rags to riches. But they did a study of the robber barons back during the Gilded Age, and 90% of them came from wealthy or upper middle class families. 10% of them actually came from poorer families. But it never was, the whole story never was, and it's never been characteristic of what happens in the country. So if you start at the bottom percentage in the United States, you have much less chance of making it to the top percentage than anywhere in the industrial world. And that includes Sweden, where you have these taxes that level things out and make things more equal.
And it's especially true with race, if the concentration of minorities very defined neighborhoods of poverty is much more difficult to break out. There was just a study out last week showing that the chances of a minority breaking out and becoming, you know, semi-wealthy or even joining the middle class from that environment is virtually zilch.
So Gary has written a 5-page paper, which in, at least is not 25 pages, so we've actually read it.
I shortened it down. Yeah.
That's right. Cut it down.
And Gary, you're focused on the recent history of how we get there. Now, you're focused on the whole structure of how we get there, but you're focusing on recent political events to help to lead to where we are today.
1970 recent, yes.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I do.
I would say that the move towards the new Gilded Age began after World War II. You know, prior to that, when the first Gilded Age ended, and we had the Great Depression, and then that was followed quickly by World War II, it put the robber barons kind of back on their heels. And,
followed quickly by Korea.
And they were bailed out by the masses. And
income inequality dropped. Right.
Right.
Income inequality dropped from the height of the Gilded Age. It dropped, and there was more money for more folks, and a lot of it's a result, I think, of unionization, which has collapsed now. But that's part of it. And the income inequality actually dropped, and now it's accelerating again. Why?
Right. Well, after the robber barons, you know, kind of got sidetracked by the other events, they started to reassert themselves. And I think a lot of it began in the Nixon administration when, I think the media is a big part of our problem. And during the Nixon administration, we took what was an objective media, and suddenly you have Spiro Agnew and Nixon blaming the media for their problems. You know,
Right. Spiro Agnew is a guy who's going to be forced to resign for taking corruption the old-fashioned way.
Should have been in prison.
Taking bags of money. You know, here's 25 grand in cash. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
And that's why he's forced to resign. So both Nixon and Agnew have a lot to hide.
And
right,
a little good journalism found it out.
So one of the ways, if you were going to plan this, is to basically start to attack and destroy the media so that the media can't report or won't report on your shenanigans. And I think that began during the Nixon administration.
The great label, liberal media, continues to this day.
It's absolutely not true.
Is absolutely not true. Rupert Murdoch, Roger Ailes, the people that run Fox News, Sinclair, so much of the media is extremely conservative, has one party that it supports.
Or they're just very, very careful and just really don't want to be seen as partisan. It doesn't matter whether if something looks partisan, they're afraid to touch it. But it's Reagan, right, Gary, that really
thank you. Yeah,
that really brings this
into
Reagan. Focus.
Reagan did a number of things. You know, staying with the media, he basically undid the fairness doctrine, and which held media accountable for acting in the public interest. So that allowed the development of Fox News Channel, for example.
So we're saying fairness doctrine goes away in 86, 87, 88, right, somewhere in there. And then within 20 years, 91% of talk radio, except for Democratic Perspective, becomes extremely conservative and angry. The Glenn Becks, the Alex Cross, all these guys. Alex,
what struck me even when I was a kid is that, you know, modestly, people with modest economic means don't own media, right? Generally speaking, that even the newspapers in my little hometown in Texas was owned by a wealthy family.
Let's get on to the other things Reagan did.
The other thing that happened during the Reagan administration, yeah, I don't think it was directly Reagan's responsibility, but that was when, proud news organizations like CBS, did away with their worldwide news bureaus.
Right.
They're gathering, you know, sources.
When I worked at CBS in New York, that's what's happening.
Right.
They were closing down all their international bureaus. It was too expensive. And so we've talked about this before. You went from having a news reporter living in a country and knowing the country well to having people sent from somewhere else when there's a crisis. That's what the news still looks like.
And too expensive is relative. The real point is that prior to that, news was never a profit center a network or other organizations.
They tried to build at CBS. They tried to build a firewall between the news and entertainment.
And they viewed, if anything, they viewed the news as a lead-in to their primetime, programming, which was the real money maker. So they suddenly, they got the idea that the news can be a money maker, and so we should start worrying about ratings.
And if it isn't, it goes.
Right.
You know, I want to say this. My journalism book in 1972 had the phrase, take your own pictures, in quotes. And by that, it meant you don't rely on CNN Special Service or Reuters, an AP, although all those wire services existed and are wonderful.
Yeah, there was competition.
You have your own people who in place to get your information and quote unquote take your own pitch. I mean, that's what they taught. I mean, that is an anachronism, and I am an anachronism myself.
You are an anachronism, Mike, but I think Gary, on your list, what I'd like to talk about is some of these things which are
I'd just like to end the discussion about the media. It's important because by emasculating the media and taking away, turning it into an infotainment source, you now have put a focus on sensationalism and anything that might drive up ratings, and you've lost objectivity and context.
I was out of J school 2 years, and I'm listening to this on the local TV station, infotainment, this young, you know, it was used as a lab. The young, the TV station in Flagstaff was used as a lab for the. They wouldn't like me to have it characterized well. But anyway, this guy's using the word infotainment as far as his journalism philosophy, and my mouth is dry. What do you mean infotainment? I want to research this guy. Did you go to same school I went to? Anyway, moving on.
So when you emasculate them, then allows you to do other things with that, get less scrutiny and less context. And so some of the other things that Reagan
There's sort of stagflation at the end of the Carter administration. It's actually improving. The situation is actually improving at the end, but it's not there enough to save Jimmy Carter. And Ronald Reagan comes in, and what does he do about things like taxes and...
He portrays the government as the enemy. I mean, he takes this general thing and says...
Why does he do that, Mike?
Why does he do that, Gary?
To justify killing government regulation of large corporations.
Exactly. And he does it for the same reason they attack the media, is to break anything that can interfere with the accumulation of wealth in a few hands. Right. And government regulations, you know, what happens in the old Gilded Age is there's deregulation. There's nothing. There's no unemployment insurance. There's nothing. If you get laid off, people are terrified. It starts out with a lot of violence trying to stop the thing. But there's also almost no controls over what they call trust in those days, which were basically, what would you call them? They're basically accumulation of wealth in such a way that competition can't take place.
I want to take these things.
And what Reagan is doing in part is bashing the federal government so that modernized versions of trust and deals can happen.
I want to tick these things off, or Gary should, that they because that we're talking philosophy. They did very real things to allow for the accumulation of wealth. Lowered the highest marginal tax rate from 70% to 50%, a BFD. Lowered capital gains taxes from 28% to 20%.
And that's where most of the wealthy make their
that's
income.
Right. Right. We understand that people are making money on money.
So if you work and you have a job and you pay your taxes, you're paying it at a higher percentage than even the theoretical number for invested wealth. The actual return on invested wealth is much greater than the theoretical, than the number that is put out. And because of ways of, there's so many ways to manipulate this. We talked about this last week.
And increasing the estate tax exemption is what one of our local bankers, your brother, believes was a big reason why the accumulation of wealth, raising it from $175,000 to $600,000.
And
you can pass on a lot. And this is Reagan now. It's been raised since then.
Yeah, but dramatically.
Dramatically.
Now,
this is how you pass on wealth.
That's not an inheritance tax. That's a death tax, Mike.
I want to sneak this in.
Thanks to Frank.
The idea has always been, and the founding fathers knew this, that we're going to provide this peaceful environment where if you're not in conflict all the time, you can get rich. Under the system that these guys had created, and they knew that people could get rich because you have the stable government, you have this peaceful thing going on, you have this control, you don't have a few people running anything because of religious purposes, so you don't have constant conflict. Without constant conflict, you can get rich here, and that's where the high taxes came from. The one thing that would kill the bucolic nature of the United States would be the accumulation of wealth in a few
and
people's
that's
hands.
What's happened.
And that's what's happened.
And what's happened is it's been from one Republican administration to another, talking about the death tax. Gary can tell you about how that term got invented. But this means that accumulated wealth passes down even more directly into families. It's concentrating wealth. And there's a whole bunch of things behind this. You know, we talked about Thomas Piketty. The amount of return on invested money is greater than the return on the increasing growth in the country, which means the money gets concentrated in fewer and fewer hands. And this tax manipulation, calling this a death tax, has allowed more and more accumulation. And I heard these programs, and one of the guys was kind of outing the whole thing, and I believe he was a Johnson & Johnson heir, and he had videos of a seminar for very, very wealthy people, and they call it the seven generation. They want to be able to pass down their wealth intact for seven generations.
And I want to point out that you know, a lot of these things don't seem like big deals, but this was all part of a plan known as trickle-down economics. The whole plan of the Reagan economic policy was to help the wealthy become even more wealthy so that, you know,
that was supposed to be better for everybody.
It was,
if the wealthy got even more wealthy than they were, that was giving them more investment money and the economy was going
to improve. People believe that to this very day.
So,
they do.
And it's
a
been
lot of them.
Completely disproven, nothing trickled down.
That's right.
It wasn't even a trickle. It was barely a drip.
But it doesn't go away, Gary. It doesn't go away. The idea doesn't go away.
It never went away.
Even if it's disproved.
Well,
idea that if you cut taxes, you're going to have such an amount of growth that you're actually going to end up with more money. Never, ever worked in one single case. But it's still a live idea repeated over and over.
It's Arizona. That's Doug Ducey's main platform.
And it goes back to the first Gilded Age, in which I love this description. They called it, instead of trickle-down, they called it horse-and-sparrow economics. When the primary mode of transportation was horses.
Yeah,
if you fed the horse enough oats, some would pass through, so the sparrows could dine on the droppings on the road. This is not new. It's been around.
You had the arguments for somebody like Carnegie. Carnegie is
trying to market that image.
is a modest.
Why do you think it got changed?
But the central argument in his article was that exactly this, trickle down economics. We're going to get super rich and we're going to help everybody else.
Yeah.
Okay. And he was trying to convince the rest of the super wealthy to live like he did, modestly and give money. The percentage that the Vanderbilts of their wealth gave to Vanderbilt University to establish it was less than 1%.
Yeah.
For all the talk, for all those monuments, and if you go back east, you'll see dozens of them to these families. It's a tiny, tiny thing. The Koch brothers are doing it now with the opera in New York. They have billions of dollars, and they're giving $1 million. It's nothing to them, but they're going to get their names on buildings.
And if their grandson comes home and says, "Hey, I need like I saw on TV last night, I need $20,000 to go to Georgetown, you know, or I need $40,000 to go to Harvard," which is where our ruling class comes from. Our ruling class doesn't come from Northern Arizona University; it's come from Yale and Harvard and Georgetown, They said, and the parents said, "Oh, okay, great. That didn't happen in my house, and I'm going to bet it didn't happen in anybody else's house."
The oil barons around Tulsa, where I'm from outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, all sent their kids back east to college. I mean, they didn't send them to Oklahoma State or something. They sent them to Harvard and Yale and Princeton, and then they came back to the U.S. Now, the middle class sent them to local universities.
Right. The grocery store kids and the teacher's kids.
Everybody went to the local colleges, teacher's colleges and universities. But they always sent their kids back in order The problem we have is this concentration of wealth. I really don't care if people wear $50,000 watches made of gold and diamonds or $100,000 knickknacks. Or when I was in Spain, I don't care that they have there's 1,000 giant yachts there from the wealthy all over Europe. I don't care about that. But money is being translated into power. And power is being translated into controlling and undermining the democracy in the United States.
I want to get to one of the other things that I think was critical to the beginning of this, or the return, if you want to look at it, there was a letter I saw published recently that, and when I was researching this, that was a letter from Ronald Reagan prior to his election. During the campaign, there was a letter to the PATCO labor union, the Air Controllers Labor Union.
Air Traffic Controllers.
Air Traffic Controllers. And they had written him asking for his policy or his point of view on their problems. They were horribly overworked, understaffed, and stressed out. And, you know, one of my former neighbors was a member of the union and an air traffic controller. And they were worried about the danger in the air. And Reagan wrote them back and said, I understand your problems. I will do everything I can to get you more money and more staff. And that was prior to the election. After the election, one of the first things he did was to basically destroy the union.
Right.
And this started a kind of a dominoes effect with other unions.
Because a lot of globalization and stuff had weakened them,
so,
I think.
So you took away the negotiating power of the labor force. At the same time, you concentrated a huge amount of wealth at the top. So that only accelerated our move towards oligarchy.
Let's take a look at that wealth. The average American believes that the richest fifth own 59% of the wealth and that the bottom 40% own 9%. The reality is strikingly different. The top 20% of U.S. households own 84% of the wealth of the country. 84%. The bottom 4%, 0.3%. In other words, a lot of the studies have been the perception that we have of what's happening
right.
is very different from the reality. So Americans think that, well, and when they polled Americans, of all Republicans and Democrats, wealthy and poor, people believed in a much more equitable distribution of the wealth. What people thought was ideal looks like Sweden with a kind of high curve at the end for people to accumulate wealth for Steve Jobs type of thing. That's what it looks like. The reality, the more you look at the reality, the more different it is. So the scientists sort of asked, and a lot of my information comes from a recent article in Scientific American where they looked at these studies. Why do 60%, let me see what Gary thinks about this. Why do 60% of the Americans think that wealth is maldistributed, unfairly distributed, but only 5% think it's an important problem?
I would point right back to the media, because the media does not inform the public on important issues. We have a public that knows more about the Jody Arias trial and the Kardashians than they know about the political issues facing our time. They know more about them than they know about geography of the Middle East.
Well, TMZ is fascinating. Well presented.
But I mean, when you see Jay Leno's jaywalking, and you see these other similar kinds of bits on television, we have a very horribly informed public. And part of that, I maintain, is because of the consolidation of the ownership. The ownership. We now have six corporations own most of the TV outlets.
It used to be hundreds.
Five corporations own most of the radio. Five corporations own most of the newspapers. Five corporations own most of the online media. And these are huge corporations that take the corporate point of view. And we now are at a point where we have CEOs. In the 80s, when Reagan took office, the typical CEO made about 40 times the amount of money that his employees did.
Right.
Now that's more than 500 times
right.
what the employees
did. Right. And I'm
so
proud of it.
Yeah.
And we expect it. And we think it's important for some reason.
And we somehow admire it. We admire Donald Trump because he's a very wealthy jerk.
Let me talk about something else.
Let me give an analyst apropos to what Gary's talking about. Krista Freeland put it, Americans actually live in Russia, where the robber barons run stuff, although they think they live in Sweden, and they would like to live on a kibbutz. The media, but also Americans' perception and traditions, blind them to the actual fact. And that's why they're not more concerned
about
what this concentration of wealth
They've been lied to over and over and over and over again. The Fox News have... anyway, I want to talk about Newt Gingrich, something else they'll recognize. The former Speaker of the House was enamored with the whole European parliamentary system in which representatives of each party vote unified in nearly every vote, or every vote, to fend off a Clinton presidency and a Clinton Congress. He got the GOP to vote lockstep. They liked that so much, even when it was not appropriate, like now, and like under the Obama administration, or they're still voting lockstep.
That's what they did Affordable Care Act.
And I'm not going to blame the current, but they did the same thing under Bush. Cheney, Bush, Rumsfeld made it sound unpatriotic to vote against the Republican Party, and it was extremely successful.
So for people, if you remember what happened with the Obamacare or the American Affordable Care changes, the Democrats spent months and months, I think 8 or 9 months, dialoguing with Republicans and trying to get votes of some of the moderates.
And accepting Republican amendments.
Exactly, accepting all these changes, all these compromises, and then the Republicans did what, Mike?
I don't know.
They voted in lockstep
against
the bill,
so
it would look worse.
That's all because of Newt Gingrich.
And that's what they're now doing with the Iran peace agreement.
And the other part of that is goes back to three guys that were nicknamed at the time the Three Amigos, that were in the College Republicans. And they rebuilt it. The College Republicans were in utter disarray.
Yeah, what self-respecting college student would belong to the Republican Party?
Especially after the Nixon administration and Watergate. And so three guys, Grover Norquist, you might remember that name of No New Tax fame, Jack Abramoff, the guy who was put in prison for corruption.
The super lobbyist, lobbyist who's talked very frankly about how he did it. I mean, we've talked on the program, you know, Jack Abramoff, this really is like, well, you know, you tell a guy that you're going to give him a nice big job after he leaves office or after his senator or congressman leaves office. He says, if he hears you and accepts that idea, you got him.
You got him.
You got him.
And the third in that little triumvirate of the Three Amigos was Ralph Reed, who became the head of the Christian Coalition and was funneling money into Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform. And those three.
What about his own pocket? Wasn't there some controversy about what he was doing with some of the money?
And Abramoff was doing the same with Native American money that he was lobbying for them. But the important thing about these three is that they rebuilt the College Republicans by viewing politics, changing the view of politics to a blood sport, to war.
Right.
And that hadn't really existed for many years prior to that. And the rest of the Republicans picked up on that and said, gee, it was so successful with the College Republicans, let's do it everywhere.
Right.
And so, you know, if you want to know why our Congress is so dysfunctional, you can track it to these three guys and Newt Gingrich.
Well, and it's completely
directly
antithetical to the system that the Founding Fathers set up. We set up this little genteel system in which compromise was necessary. We all remember the compromise the compromises that happened and the people who did it,
the Constitution.
Exactly.
It's a compromise document.
So we had this system that was based on compromise, not on this parliamentary system of screaming at each other. And yet that's what they're trying to do. Now, there are certain pundits that believe, political science professors that believe that the system is so strong and so good that sooner or later they're going to go away. Sooner or later they're going to realize that the amount of harm that they're doing to the rank and file American is going to be so great that they're going to have to back off of the slash and burn Republican policy.
Who's going to do this, Mike? I mean, the Republicans themselves
American
people looking at what they're doing?
Well, good question. The Republicans themselves will see that their positions and their decisions are harming and damaging wage increases. They're harming and damaging health, so much healthcare. Babies, you know, how many thousands of Americans die without healthcare, or at least prior to ACA? How stagnant are wages? How many jobs do you have? How many minimum wage jobs do you have to be able to just live?
I know that some of the oligarchs are now talking about, you know, living wages and increases in stuff to try to move over and co-opt.
Hail Bernie,
occupy, you know, the United States movement, which why would they change, though, Mike? I mean, I don't see any evidence that they would. Argue with me here.
Gary probably would give a better answer.
Well, I think in self-interest, because
they still need us. They still need us.
My first job,
question is, do they need us? Actually,
that's another question.
My first job, I had a coworker who was much more liberal and socialist than I, and he used to. I always viewed myself as being practical, and he always used to say, sooner or later, those without are going to come take it from those with. And I think it's self-interest on the part of the oligarchs. If they're not careful, if they keep pressing this agenda, which it is, it's a long-term agenda, mm-hmm. if they keep pressing it, sooner or later, there is going to be a huge rebellion, going to hurt them.
And what happened in the Gilded Age was just that. You've got the labor unions, you've got socialists, you've got anarchists, you've got the farm movement, you've got the populist movement, you've got a progressive movement.
Communist movement.
You've got all these things in response to this vast distribution of wealth. Things seem sort of quiet now, Gary. People don't seem concerned about
the
here. Concentration of wealth.
How did we get here? We're here. We got to mention George Bush. We can't get through this 45 minutes without mentioning George Bush. The income tax cuts created a new 10% bracket for single filers with taxable income up to $6,000, joint filers $12,000, heads of household $10,000. The 15% bracket was indexed to the new 10%, the 28 to the 25%, 31 to 28. Anybody that spent a few minutes with their tax person, even an H&R Block, has heard this, 36% to 33%. So the wealthiest got this incredible tax break, thereby increasing the deficit.
Their tax break is 4.6, as Gary has in his notes.
They got cut by 4.6.
It got cut by 4.6%. You're cutting 4.6% of the people who have all the money. And so that's a much bigger tax cut for them. That, you know, hundreds of thousands instead of $500 for the lower tax bracket. So if even in statistics, kind of, you have to think through their actual impact of these.
Well, let's finish the rate. Reagan cut that. The member that talked about that estate and gift tax inheritance. It went from $600,000, you know, in 2000, which said 2 million in 2006, to the 3.5 million in 2009, to 5.4 million now. So
that's the exclusion. In other words, you can leave 5.4 million, and before this taxes, estate taxes start, and they start. They never include the 5.4 million. If you have 150 million above that, and you don't have good tax lawyers, then the tax actually starts.
And there's all sorts of ways to avoid estate taxes to begin
and
with.
You get the lawyers and the accountants on it, and then you pass it.
When I studied estate planning, it was the sneakiest area of economic planning, with the most tricks and the most devious stuff. They said, well, look, you've got a family corporation. They build widgets. They've got a lot of money. You explain to them what the tax liabilities are. They've got $100 million to leave. They said, just explain everything to them and then leave the room. Go sit somewhere else and have them work out what they're going to do. And then you go back into the room and they tell you, you know, the information you need to make sure that they don't pay any taxes when they pass on their business.
There are the little tricks that I did this for one university when I was working in an ad agency. There are little tricks where you can, if you have a very expensive piece of property, you can donate it to a university, for example, and let the university, take the income off of it for 5 years or 10 years, and then after they take the income for that period of time, then it's given back to whoever you designate it should go to, so you can pass it on to your children that way. There are all sorts of tricks like that that have been going on in the Ivy League schools for years and years and years and years.
For example, you know, if you have a $100 million company or $500 million company, you die, the company is evaluated at the stock market price when you die. And therefore, your heirs actually don't owe any money on it. They don't have to pay any taxes on this $500 million unless there's an inheritance tax.
Let's jump ahead to the big thing, I think, that has contributed to the oligarchy, is the U.S. Supreme Court, the five conservatives on the Supreme Court, where in three decisions, they totally changed, you know, the election financing, and we've talked about them before. Buckley versus Valeo, which is the decision that equates money with free speech. It's the Citizens United versus the FCC, which equated corporations with people. And, McCutcheon versus the FEC, which eliminated almost all limits on campaign donations. So what that's done is, so far in this year's presidential campaign, fewer than 400 families have contributed half of the nearly 400 million so far donated to presidential candidates this year.
I think we said on the program on the Republican candidates, which we had a lot of fun with them, and there are actually some good candidates in there. Was that you could line the candidates up and have little cardboard figures of the billionaires who are backing them, standing right behind them.
Wearing
NASCAR
suits.
We talked about Rubio being backed by a single billionaire for most of his career, but it's also true when Newt Gingrich ran, he had one billionaire. When he ran out of money, the billionaire stepped up and kept it. So money is getting concentrated in very few hands in the modern United States, and the reasons for it, the economic reasons, are very complicated. But what we're really concerned about is the effect of this concentration of wealth in a very few hands on American democracy.
Well, the other thing, I'm going to sum up lobbying as the other big impact on democracy, and by saying $28 billion going to lobbyists between we're talking in our lifetime, a 40-year-old's adult life. You know, 1997, he graduated from high school, and now he or she is 40. So this is their memory. From 98 to 2010 and to now, we're talking about $28 billion spent. Only $500 million of that is labor, by the way. The rest is all in business and transportation and all those other things that get lobbied. So anytime there's a lobbyist involved, well, that takes away the representative.
And don't forget ALEC, the American Legislation.
That's my next
thing.
We've talked about ALEC before on the show. As far as I'm concerned, we should talk about it every week.
What it is it's an organization of conservative legislators around the country who get together with large corporations and allow the corporations to write the legislation, and then they take it back to their own state legislatures, sponsor it, and it goes through hardly with any discussion or input by the citizens themselves.
You have two positive notes here. Bernie Sanders. I went to see Bernie down in Phoenix. But here's what's going on with Bernie, to me anyway. The Democrats, the liberals won't – they're afraid that Bernie can't win, and so they're not supporting him. Don't get me wrong, there's people, every rally is, you know, dwarfing the Republicans. So a positive note is Bernie Sanders, but who's Lawrence Lessig?
Lessig is a law professor from Harvard who has vowed to run for president with a crowdsourced campaign. And he, with one issue and one issue only, is to change the way we finance elections. And as soon as he gets that done, he'll resign and turn it over to his vice president.
We've got a whole series of interesting interviews and programs coming up. Folks, tune in the next few weeks. We'd like to thank Democrats of the Red Rocks for their support.
Oh, yes, we do.
And what else, Mike?
We want to take on National Monument, big local issue. That seems to be, they're losing it. The National Monument people are, it's gotten controversial, but it's kind of fun if you step back a little bit. But anyway, please
they're
go to...
They're like stampeded critters, the opponents.
Well, Tom's got a big lock on the door.
again listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 o'clock news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.